My name is Julian Chambliss. I'm a professor of English at Michigan State University. It is July 8th, 2021. And I'm speaking with Regina Bradley. Regina, do I have your permission to record you?
Yes.
Regina, do I have your permission to add this recording to the Vincent West Library at Michigan State University, and it will be available for students and the public for educational purposes?
Yes.
Regina, do I have your permission to use the audio from this interview for a podcast project called Every Tongue Got to Confess, which is a podcast project supporting the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of Arts and Humanities, and it distributed electronically worldwide on an annual basis?
Yes.
Thank you for those permissions. I will, as I say, follow up with written documentation for you. So my first question for people, because as I mentioned, our goals here are to think about definitions around Afrofuturism. And of course, I associate you with sound Afrofuturism. Is, could you define Afrofuturism for me?
I feel like I'm in a dissertation defense. So, I mean, for me, it's Afrofuturism is the use of technology and possibilities of the future for Black folks to think about themselves outside of their current past circumstances and trying to create a space to be free to do of their own will, their own volition, whatever, however they want, using science fiction and technology.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's
weird because it's like, I don't necessarily consider myself an Afrofuturist. I think I'm an Afrofuturist by association because of the people that I hang out with. So it's like, I kind of look at them and be like, yeah. But I mean, like for me, I feel like it's an emancipation practice. Like it's a practice of how Black folks can get free, you know what I'm saying? And usually those type of conversations are restricted if you're thinking about them strictly through history or strictly through, you know what I'm saying, social circumstance. But I think the opportunity to use imagination as an act of liberation for Black folks, using science fiction, using technology, using all of these restrictive methods of practice of creativity, you know what I'm saying, is something that Afrofuturism is really useful for. And I feel like especially amplified with me being a Southerner, a Black Southerner from Southwest Georgia, is that, you know, science fiction and tech were allowed me to think about myself outside of these normative understandings of Southerness and the Black experience. And gave me a little leeway, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that that's what so many of us are looking for, but I feel like Afrofuturism is the way to do that.
Well, I think, I was going to say, like, I think that's a pretty reasonable answer. There is no wrong answer to that question. I like to point that out to people. But I do also want to unpack a little bit, and this will get to this question, like, how you came upon the work that you're doing. Because as a person who I associate with sound and Afrofuturism, I think one of the things that comes through in your work is the kind of flexibility and fluidity that is in your definition.
Oh, thank you.
Right? So when you think about what you write about and you think about sound, that's actually a really strong sort of overlay. And this idea of like a liberatory practice, especially coming from someone from the South.
Yeah.
The idea that the voice is a liberatory tool mm-hmm. is not actually out of bounds and corresponds, of course, with the context of perhaps someone like Zora Neale Hurston, who right. concentrates very much on oral practice mm-hmm. and Black vernacular and so on and so forth. So when you think about the work that you're doing, thinking about Southern hip hop, which, again, one way that we sometimes describe Afrofuturism almost from the very beginning was as a sound practice. And we attached it to pioneering individual sound artists.
Right.
And in particular, they were jazz artists and they were hip hop mm-hmm. artists mm-hmm. and electronic music artists. And one thing that we should note, and I think your work called our attention to is like that happens in the South, and when it happens in the South, it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think that would be a really simple way of me simplifying what you. That's really me simplifying a very complicated argument coming from you. So I apologize. But
I mean, if you can simplify, that means that I did something right. You know what I'm saying? Some folks be out here giving you arguments like, wait, what?
Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, if you can simplify, then it was you did a good job. I always feel that way personally.
I'm gonna take that. I'm gonna take that as a win.
So there's a question here about geography. There's a question here about practice.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question here about culture, and it creating a unique stew.
Mm-hmm.
Potluck. There's a particular thing that's happening, which is if you're not Southern, potluck is the liquid that's in the pot after you take all the
pot liquor.
But yeah, right, like all the stuff, right? And at some level, you're really referencing a very complex set of synergies that are being played out. And I want to like ask you to sort of talk a little bit about how you came to think about it that way.
I think it's with all good research, you know what I'm saying? I'm, you know, this Zorna Hurst podcast, but I mean, like I subscribe to her school of thought in terms of, you know what I mean? It's hard to distinguish personal experience from the stuff that you research and engage. And I fall into that, you know what I'm saying? And you know, when I think about sound, unfortunately for a lot of folks, they think sound studies is just an extension of something like ethnomusicology, which is like, oh, music does this. But I think that one of the things I really try to advocate for in my work is, yeah, I mean, the music is important, you know what I'm saying, which I'll get to in just a second, but also the non-musical cues that are associated with Black experiences, particularly Black experiences in the South, are very underutilized in understanding why Southern Blackness is such a complicated thing. So we think about, you know, the significance of Zora Neale Hurston, particularly her work with the WPA and when she was doing oral histories, is she was giving folks an opportunity to speak their own truths, right? And that's something that Black folks so often get denied, is just literally speaking our truth. You know what I'm saying? It hurts feelings. Or, you know, it makes folks uncomfortable. Usually it makes white folks uncomfortable, because that's usually what folks are talking about. That's, you know, I'm not quite sure you can take this out. It's on that bullshit, you know, but I mean, like, you know, considering contemporary conversation right now about CRT and just the idea of race, like folks are scared to say the word race, let alone racism. You know what I'm saying? When folks are actually talking about like white supremacy and pushing back against ideas of white supremacy. So, you know, with somebody like Hurston, who is allowing folks to speak their unequivocal truth, like not telling them to dress it up or dress it down. I mean, like, you know, folks talking in their vernaculars, talking in their dialect and telling you stories and how they're eating. All of those things are important to a longer conversation about how Black folks express themselves unapologetically, right? Like, I think in addition to Afrofuturism being a tool of liberation, is also a space to be unapologetically oneself, or envision what an unapologetic self would look like, right? So, you know, but from the music perspective, you know, you said jazz, and I'm definitely with that. You know what I'm saying? You have to know how to do improvisation, you know what I mean, to make it actually stick. But my introduction to Afrofuturism actually through funk music. So, you know, listening to, you know, like the Sun Ra's and Earth, Wind & Fires and Parliament and George Clinton, you know, the Ohio Players, you know what I'm saying? All of these folks that my dad was listening to. So like, technically my dad is my introduction to Afrofuturism through funk music, you know what I mean? And my dad kind of talking about these worlds that these artists were creating in their music, you know what I mean? From a land like fantasy and Earth, Wind & Fire to the mothership, you know what I'm saying? And then realizing that those conversations, that they were in conversation with the Southern hip hop folks that I was listening to, like the Outkasts and the Goody Mobs and, you know what I'm saying, the 3-6 Mafias, right? So being able to connect not only personal experience, but musical inclination, it didn't happen by mistake. You know what I mean? Like, one of the things that I often teach my students over and over is that the South, particularly the Black South, isn't a monolithic experience that's linear. It's an experience that is circular, cyclical. You know what I'm saying? Like, we revisit things time and time again. And I feel like that happens with funk music and Southern hip hop, especially. But also just being able to, you know, engage the understandings of how or why sound is important, because sound for Black folks for so long was so censored. You know what I'm saying? Like, you couldn't speak a certain way. You couldn't speak, period. You couldn't, you know, music, what's that? But being able to use sound is kind of like the scapegoat of the norm. You know what I mean? So, like, you might hear a Negro spiritual, for example, but I mean, like, it's really directions to get free. But if you don't know that those are directions to get free, you're like, oh, they're just singing a gospel song or they're singing whatever. But I'm like, no, we're giving you directions. You know what I mean? You know, and thinking about, you know, what that sounds like, especially when you think about, like, the other subgenres that come out of it. So, like, you know what I'm saying, Afro steampunk, for example, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not just coming out of this idea of Britain, you know, as it's kind of like industrialized. I'm like, no, Black folks have put their own stank on it, so to speak. Some of my inner outcasts here, right? Put their this particular stank on it. And sometimes that's not legible to a non-Black audience. And that's okay. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's the thing that's so great, is that as Afrofuturism is consistently making its way to mainstream, you know what I'm saying? There's still, like, that underlying, you know, sensibility that's like, there's still a little something in there just for Black folks, you know, and being able to be like, oh, okay, I got that. So it's almost like it's a map. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a map to continue these conversations across generations, across decades and centuries, using creativity to do that.
So one of the things that I think is important for people to wrestle with, especially when you think about Afrofuturism as a sound practice, is this idea that is both the practice of the Afrofuturism, the practice of the sound and the sound itself that kind of represent a kind of intersection that is sort of liberatory. Mm-hmm. And the implication here for different genres is sometimes very, very distinct. So in the case of hip hop, you can sort of point to particular moments in history and particular figures where they are intersecting or intervening in practice and creating something new. And that in itself becomes like, okay, this is Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And then there's the, as you say, the sound itself, like how they're creating these worlds, and that makes it Afrofuturism. And so in the context of your work in particular, because of your focus on trying to understand the Southern element here, which I think is an important part of, like, how we understand, at least in the American context.
Right.
In the American context, an Afrofuturist practice. Where do you put the weight in terms of, like, trying to understand a kind of Southernness to Afrofuturism? Because I think you could make an argument if you sort of stand back and you apply a kind of analytical lens, you make an argument that there's a particular Southernness to a future, a speculative practice that is very important to understand its implications about the possible futures being called into being. And that's a subtle way of understanding it, but I do think that it's there. And I feel sometimes in your work in particular, you get a sense of what that might look like, what that might feel like. And I wonder, is that something that you think about and as you approach the work yourself?
Yeah, it's I mean, like, sometimes I feel it happens on accident. You know what I'm saying? Other times I feel like it's a type of ancestral pulling, like, my, you know, folks who are around, they're like, I'm tired you talk about the ancestors. I'm like, but the ancestors be messing with me, so of course I'm gonna talk about them. But what I mean by that is, you know what I mean, because we're, you know, is what I was kind of saying earlier, because we're, I think about Southern Blackness as cyclical, you know what I'm saying, then we have to revisit some of these things that are continuously coming up in the ways that we remember, in the ways that we speak, you know what I'm saying, dialect, you know what I'm saying, slang. Even, you know, being able to tell stories that are passed down, like gathering spaces, you know, like these differing places that come together, they come together for a reason, and they come together for that. And that reason is amplified when you think about the sonic elements of that. You know what I mean? When you think about a cookout, for example, there's a certain playlist, or there's a certain, you know, there's laughter, there's things that you listen for that as time goes on, you know, you might lose people, people might not be able to attend. So I mean, like, the ability for sound to both hold space but also engage, you know, this idea of remembrance about how to continue these things moving forward is an underappreciated element of that. And I think too, what's equally as important in thinking about sound from a Southern Black construct is in the same way that, you know what I'm saying, Southernness isn't a monolithic experience, Southern Blackness is a monolithic experience, and that definitely means the way that Southern Black folks sound is different. The way that I sound being from Southwest Georgia is different than somebody who was raised in New Orleans. It's different than somebody who was raised, you know what I'm saying, in North Carolina or Kentucky, but we're all in conversation with each other. You know what I'm saying? There's love there. And I think that being able to recognize those differences and even those at most points nuanced and subtle differences in those experiences is what makes sound study so significant in understanding region as it applies. You know what I'm saying? But I also think too, is what's particularly interesting for me is that probably one of the most unique examples of Afrofuturism from a Southern perspective is the reverse migration that's taking place. Like, folks left in the early 20th century to go and pursue, you know, dreams or, you know, it wasn't just Black folks trying to escape. Like, that's the one thing that really just kind of pisses me off is like when they were like, oh, Black people were trying to escape the South. It was such a traumatized space. And I'm like, that's doing a disservice to folks who might have migrated across the South. You might have moved from Texas to Georgia or from Florida to Alabama. You know what I'm saying? Everybody wasn't trying to get out of the South. And I feel like that does an injustice. But now you see that folks are coming back South. You know what I'm saying? And it's not like they are an empty vessel in the same way that the folks who migrated out of the South in the early 20th century weren't an empty vessel. They didn't just bring their bodies. They brought their culture. They brought the way that they spoke, the way that they, you know what I'm saying, the way that they cooked, the kind of music they were listening to. And then that hybridized with whatever the local culture was where they came from. All of that is part of the sonic experience. You know what I mean? And what's interesting too is in ideas of migration, particularly migrations across the region, is something that I think about, especially in hip hop, because of the collaborations that are happening. You know what I mean? Like, folks don't just exist in their own little vacuum. So you have folks who are in Louisiana who are, you know what I'm saying, collaborating with artists from Atlanta or collaborating with artists from Miami, or you have these artists moving to these new locations and bringing that sound and those experiences with them. So then when you get to something like a Hurricane Katrina, which forced people to, you know, be dispersed and displaced even, that too impacts the sonic narrative that's in place, especially for folks who can't go back. So if you can't go back to a place that either no longer exists or you can't afford to go back, how do you, you know, sustain your attachment to it? The way that you talk, the way that you listen, the way that you, you know, consume the music, you know what I'm saying? So I think that thinking about sonic ways in the South is not only an extension of Afrofuturism, because you're doing that guesswork, so to speak, but it's also an opportunity to be able to see how these differences are made tangible in ways that aren't restrictive by the academy or restricted by, well, they said this is how it's supposed to be. So still leaning on that definition of futurism as an opportunity to renegotiate and reconsider what these things that folks kind of consider as done deals, you know what I mean? And breaking that up and seeing how that manifests differently.
I really appreciate the sort of complexity that you're bringing to, like, a kind of Southernness, apart from a kind of traumatized narrative, right?
Like, sick of it. I'm sick of it. I'm like, yes, trauma exists, right, but it's not the only thing. You know what I'm saying?
I do understand that. Because I think, you know, it's very difficult for white people to think about Black people as Southern. Like, I've always been, like, shocked by this. I'm like, I am so Southern, it hurts. Like, I was born in Alabama and I moved South. Like, I grew up in Florida. It's not even funny, right? I do not count as anything other than Southern. But of course, no one, it's very difficult for white people to think about Black people as Southern, because one way to, you know, this is really off topic, but, like, you know, like, Black people like livestock or something. Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm. No, that doesn't work, right? Like, Yeah, I have feelings about the place too.
Yeah.
Just not your feelings.
It's amazing how, like, when you remove white folks from the center of what it means to be Southern, they lose their mind. What do you mean you're not? You don't think about the trauma? And I'm like, if the only thing I had to live on was trauma, the whole Black South would be dead by now. Like, it wouldn't even exist. You know what I mean? You got to find the pockets of resilience. You got to find the pockets of joy. But also, like, it really does. I really enjoy doing this when I have these type of conversations about the Black South with Southern studies in particular, because it's so hella white. You know what I'm saying? It's like, what do you mean you don't include William Faulkner in the discussion of Jesmyn Ward? I'm like, yeah, no, I don't need Faulkner to talk about Jesmyn Ward.
Right.
I don't need white folks to talk about Southern Black folks, because when white folks talk about Southern Black folks, we're usually secondary. We're never in command. We're never at the forefront. We're always an afterthought, or we're a stepping stool to a white person having like this epiphany that the world is jacked up. You know what I'm saying? I don't exist like that. And my experiences being Southern don't exist like that. And Julian, probably your experiences ain't really like that. I mean, like, yeah, we knew white folks was there, but they weren't the be all end all, which white folks realize they're not the be all end all, they whole world fall apart.
Well, you know,
fall apart.
It does call attention to the challenge offered by Afrofuturism as a cataloging, right? Yes. And so, because of course Afrofuturism tends to decenter whiteness and goes towards like a kind of Africanness. And so one way that we can think about Afrofuturism is a catalog, right? Like, it's a way to understand, as you say, like an evolution of Blackness. And I think in particular, when we think about this in the context of hip hop and sound, you know, these are different iterations, different tools for different generations. Like, I teach a class on Afrofuturism, we do sound, and like, you know, Black people are innovating in the sound space all the time. You just got to see it, right? So people in the 19th century talking out loud about freedom, they're innovating and they're using sound. They're providing a certain kind of information.
Yes.
Right? Like, you're doing that with gospel music, with its double meaning. You're doing it with other things. And so it becomes a really interesting way to chronicle a kind of information system, a technological cultural information system, like an ecosystem. And in particular, I think when you talk about the rise of Southern hip hop, those permutations across the system, because if you use that metaphor of technology, then actually the South is a system, and it has very particular nodes, and those nodes are highly adaptable to the environment mm-hmm. they're in.
Yes.
So that, like, Miami's node is not like Atlanta's node. It's not like New Orleans node. It's not like Memphis node, because mm-hmm. those nodes are like, they're affected by the environment.
Yes.
It's like an organic technology, if you want to use a sci-fi metaphor. And so, you know, when you're considering the work that you've done with hip hop, that really sort of gets at the nature of these kind of organic systems that are mm-hmm. created by Black people and the communities of practice that are reflected in that. And there are different takes on the same idea of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
So if, you know, if you were to like sort of point people to like think about, you know, this journey of liberation as an ideological system in these places, mm-hmm. what are things that you want them to know?
Well, I really like that idea of it being like an organic system. I mean, like, it is really an organic system of information that's continuously passed down. You know what I'm saying? I think that's really smart. I also think that folks can't rely on these flattened and often essentialized definitions of what freedom means for Black folks in the South. You know what I'm saying? Because the go-to expression of freedom is from, you know, enslaved folks. Like, this is what it means to literally be free. Like, that's the go-to definition. If I was like, give me what it means to be free, they either go to slavery or they go to the civil rights movement. And I'm like, that does such a huge disservice, one, for the work that those folks have done previous to us, but also makes no room for us to speak about what those challenges of liberation look like for folks after these emancipation movements that folks are so stuck on. You know what I'm saying? And when I say that they're stuck on it, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it becomes the be all end all for cementing a conversation about what liberatory practices look like for Black folks. And as somebody who wasn't around during the movement, you know what I'm saying? Who only heard stories and snippets about those freedom movements from my grandparents and from elders within my community, you know what I'm saying? There, the sense of attachment is different for me than it is for them. You know what I mean? In the same ways that, like, when we look back on these freedom movements that are springing up now, you know, in a post George Floyd era, post Breonna Taylor era, my attachment to those movements runs parallel to the attachment of my elders to the previous movements, like the civil rights movement and so forth. So I think what needs to happen is that folks need to make room to have multiple cycles of conversations about what freedom looks like, how it manifests, how it's tangible to people. And for a lot of folks, the tangibility of emancipation is through technology, actual technology, social media, you know what I'm saying? Hashtags, TikToks, all those things that I don't know how to do, right? I just have to watch and be like, oh, that's cool. You know what I'm saying? But it is creating a particular type of archive or building upon an archive, right? Like, you know, and I guess the second part of that is challenging folks to renegotiate what they think an archive is, because oral tradition is an archive. You know what I mean? The music is an archive. You know, just hashtags are archives. You know what I'm saying? So being able to recognize how these bodies of work are continuously breathing and evolving does more of a service than saying, oh, okay, well, if it's Southern Black people talking about, you know, freedom and all of that, of course we're going to go to the 1950s and 1960s. That's just what's immediately recognizable. A lot of folks are scared to do that work, to do the work of, okay, what does freedom mean in 2021, and not using what was going on in 1961 as the be all end all, rather than as a springboard for a conversation. Folks would be like, well, if you didn't do it like this, then it must be on y'all, right? Like, then you get into that idea about generational anxiety, which is something I feel like we don't talk about enough. You know, generational anxiety, the way that Black folks feel they should carry themselves in order to have access to particular rights and experiences is different from my grandmother than it is for me. We were raised in two totally different moments, but they overlap, which is something that happens in the South on a regular basis. So being able to engage and actually name that generational anxiety, that generational tension in terms of how we present ourselves, how we create, how we think through. Even going back to somebody like Zora Neale Hurston, like, one of the things that stands out most about her work for me is the fact that even in the face of her peers and her colleagues and the Elaine Locks and the Du Boises who are like, no, you're not doing Black people a service by showing, you know, how we actually speak, how we actually talk, and still being willing to pursue that particular type of knowledge, is important in the same way that, you know, I find myself in that kind of generational transition where my students and my daughter, who's 20, you know what I'm saying? They look at the world different than I did coming up in, you know what I'm saying, the 90s and the early 2000s. It's different for them. There's been particular work that's been done. So ultimately, I just feel like it's an acknowledgement of the differing narratives around what freedom practices look like and also how those influence your day-to-day cultural experiences.
If people were to ask you, and this is an unfair question, but I think it's important to ask Asperger's question.
Okay.
If people would ask you, like, these are the sound artists, the sound practices you have to know understand, sort of like, you know, this sort of Black speculative acoustic oral AURAL a liberatory practice. Who would you say, like, these are the people you need to listen to?
This ain't even right.
I know. People ask me questions like this all the time, like, what are the most important Afrofuturist thing? I'm like, oh man, well, how much time you have? And if I say a list, someone's gonna come along and go, like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's, there's always that.
You and know. like, I don't think it's fair, but you know, it's not fair. On the other hand, you can have lots of caveats. Like you say something like, hey, I just wrote a book about the rise of hip hop in the South. True. Obviously, I think Southern hip hop artists are very important. And of course, the first among many is Outkast. And then I would go, blah, 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 right? Like, there's
I mean, you're doing my work for me. I just feel like, I mean, yeah, I feel like, you know what I'm saying, in order to sonically appreciate the possibilities of Afrofuturism, you have to listen to funk. Like, you have to listen to Parliament. You have to listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire. Southern hip hop wise, you have to listen to Outkast, because Outkast, you know what I'm saying, was under the tutelage of Organized Noise. So anything about Organized Noise show you what the possibilities of futurity look like using music. Like, even, you know, even more recent folks, I would say listen to somebody like Big Crit, right? And how he challenges not only the blues tradition, not necessarily challenges, but embraces both the blues tradition and also this larger kind of Americana musical experience. And I mean, you know, some folks will say to listen to like EDM. I don't necessarily listen to EDM like that, but you know, you gave me the caveat, because I study and engage in Southern hip hop culture and stuff like that. That's my foundation is Southern artists. You know what I'm saying? And you know, I said Earth, Wind, and Fire, but also Sun Ra. He's from Alabama. I mean, he said he's from Jupiter, but he's from Alabama for real though. That's what the birth certificate said. You know what I'm saying? So I'll be like, those Alabama experiences impacted him to the point where he's like, I don't even want to be on Earth no more. Y'all on that mess. I'm going to space. which you can see in works like Outkast, ATLians. You know what I'm saying? If you listen to ATLians, you can hear that. You can hear the influence of, you know, stuff like The Zither and Star Trek and all of these kind of like out of this world space things, you know what I mean? Which, I mean, like, I think one of the things that I always laugh about is I don't understand when folks get mad, like if you see, like if Star Wars brings something out and they bring out a non-white main character, I'm like, what do you think? You think that the rest of outer space is white? Like, it ain't just white, you know what I'm saying? Like, just help me understand. Everybody's not white, right? So I just feel like, you know, being able to engage musically, but also non-musical cues too. You know what I'm saying? Like if you listen to like the oral tradition, still oral storytellers, you know what I mean? I think that's important. There's a reason that somebody like a Sonia Sanchez, who's also from Alabama, Alabama got some magic in them roots. Like you could just sit and listen to her talk for hours. Just listen to her talk, because you hear that little bit of twang, but you also understand and hear like she's not just speaking for herself, right? Like when DJ Spooky is like, the voice you speak with is not your own. I feel like he's really talking to Black folks, especially Southern Black folks. So yeah, you gonna have to get in on the funk, get in on the Outkast and the Organized Noise, you know what I mean? And also, I mean, something, you know, like an HBCU band, like a Southern HBCU band, you know what I'm saying? To take music that was already out and remix it to be part of a catalog that's uniquely from the school. Everybody doesn't play the Jacksons' Can You Feel It the same way. Everybody doesn't play Juvenile's, you know, Back That Ass Up the same way. You know what I'm saying? So I think being able to see how sound and sound production resonates in these different pockets of society is definitely the way to go in terms of thinking about how complicated the sonic lineage is of Black folks, especially Southern Black folks.
You know, one definition of Afrofuturism that I think is always really important to take into account is that Afrofuturism offers a kind of Black take on modernity.
Yes.
And this is particularly important, of course, in sound, again, because both the product and the practice tend to be hyper modern. Like they are speaking to that moment mm-hmm. in time. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about this question of modernity and you sort of project forward, because another thing about sound, Afrofuturism, of course, is the chronopolitic of it, right? Like, there's very complicated politics around time mm-hmm. and inherent, and you alluded to in your last answer when you talk about like you're not speaking for yourself, so you're speaking for ancestors. You're dealing with the past, and there's always this question of the future. And so, when you start thinking about how this work is in negotiating with the past, which is almost always the case with hip hop, right? Like it's a mining the past sounds to create the new sound. It's so important to hip hop. Literally like going through the crates, right? Like there's like a tactile nature to it.
Yep.
But when you try to project that forward, like what do you see on the horizon for this kind of practice?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, part of me is hesitant to answer the question because I feel like I'm on the porch, so to speak. Like I shake my fist at the younger folks walking by, like y'all don't know nothing about. So there's that part of me. But I, you know, one of the things I have to say is that the South always has one foot in the past, one foot in the future. Never has solid footing in the present because we're always grappling with one or the other. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like, in thinking about modernity, you know, an obvious answer would be, you know, the use of social media, which, I mean, I use it, but I feel like I can't theorize it, you know what I'm saying, in the ways that, you know, some other folks can. And this is something that I often tell my students is like, you know, my area of expertise or comfort stops at a particular, you know what I'm saying? When folks ask me to talk about more recent artists, like recent, I can't, like, I'm like, I can't sit there and engage and theorize in the same way as I can with older artists. And part of that is because I grew up listening to those artists. So that's like a lifetime of listening, a lifetime of thinking about, you know, that lasting significance. But what I can say is because of the fluidity and sound's ability to resonate, echo, if you will, in different ways across different genres and experiences, is that you can't talk about the future without sounding it. You know what I mean? Like to be able to identify a particular type of modernity is engaged in the way that that modernity is produced. So if you're thinking about modernity from a visual perspective, you know what I mean? You're going to visualize it in a particular way. If you're thinking about it from, a sonic perspective, then you have to include sound. But I also think too, the idea of modernity is only comfortable for folks if it's through a medium that they're comfortable with. So it's like, oh, if I'm thinking about Afrofuturism, of course I'm thinking about, I can visualize it. You know what I mean? And, but it's like, it's different when you're like, well, what does that sound like? You know what I'm saying? Like, so being able to ask those questions. So I guess that's just a roundabout way of saying is, you know, it's the mode of production, the way that we're pushing forward modernity needs to be considered through multiple mediums, right? And not restrictive, because Afrofuturism isn't restrictive. It's not just restricted to music. It's not just restricted to comics. It's not just restricted to, you know, to art. I think being able to, you know, recognize the multimodal experiences of modernity, being able to recognize modernity as a multimodal experience, that's what I was trying to say, is necessary in order to see where Black folks fit into that modernity on their own terms. Like, I think that's the other thing too, is like being able to establish a framework for these things in ways that aren't dictated by those who are not in the culture, those who are not part of the experience. And that's something, unfortunately, that Black folks are continuously grappling with, whether it's, you know, folks are appropriating culture and experiences or just simply saying that's not what Black folks need to be doing. Y'all need to be doing this. I don't feel like that's a representation of modernity. I feel like modernity is the unapologetic, you know what I'm saying, showing up of Black folks and not apologizing for it, being unapologetic about it, but also making space so that even those instances and experiences that make us uncomfortable are still recognized and still represented in this longer conversation about what Black folks do to move forward.
I think that's a really good answer, actually. And I'm going to end it on an answer because I think it is a good answer. And the future is unwritten. As always, and it doesn't matter how we might project. I mean, I cannot predict literally the sounds that will matter in the future, although I know sound will be a part of it. And then I think that's a true statement no matter what moment in time you're Because I'm sure if we were to talk to older people, we'd be like, the sounds that you kids listen to, right?
Yeah.
Like, what,